Well, hello again, and welcome to this week's episode of Politics in the Pulpit, which is a lectionary-based preaching resource that likes to relate next Sunday's readings with what's going on in the world. My name is Michael Wakelin. I worked for the BBC for many years, and I'm now Executive Chair of the Religion Media Centre, Executive Producer of Pause for Thought on Radio 2, and a founding partner of the Religion and Belief Literacy Partnership. As usual, I'm very pleased to say that I'm not the one providing the wit and wisdom for this podcast this week. That's in the safe-ish hands of Paul Carenza, who's a very wonderful man, a very funny stand-up comedian, having performed all over the place, and top comedy writer with TV credits including Miranda, Not Going Out with Lee Mack, Top Gear, and many more. He's written tons of books and is fabulously well-informed, aka geeky, on the history of broadcasting. But most importantly, he's one of our absolute best contributors to Pause for Thought with Zoe Ball. Wonderful to have you with us, Paul.
Thank you, Michael. I can't possibly live up to that introduction, but I thank you for it.
And you are actually quite a historian of broadcasting, aren't you? I've discovered, and your knowledge goes very deep indeed. And you've been celebrating lots of 100-year anniversaries for the BBC.
I have, yeah. My this project came about a few years ago, during the start of the pandemic, really, when I started digging a bit into radio history, and I could see the centenary of the BBC coming up. And about 2 years from when I began working on this, I thought I'll try a TV drama about this. And that was the BBC passed on that because it was a little bit looking back and early years, and they wanted to look forward, I think, so I'm writing a book about it. And then I thought to do this research, I thought it'd be nice to know not just a bit about the early days, but I thought, can I just be like the go-to person on this? Let's give ourselves that. And I had the pandemic. I had all my stand-up work cancelled.
Yeah.
So and the centenaries keep coming. So yeah, last week it was the earliest BBC recording, which was of George V in 1924. And then in a few weeks' time, we've got The Cello and the Nightingale, which, a lovely tale of this Surrey garden, giving almost the world's first outside broadcast of a nature moment. So yeah, I just love the idea behind early broadcasting, and I'd taken for granted, I think, how revolutionary it was, the idea you could actually speak to people beyond your own walls. Before that, the telephone could do that, but apart from that, this idea, and we're still employing that today. And certainly in the pandemic, the way that we couldn't go to church anymore, we have to then all become broadcasters, live streamers, podcasters, and the like to try and keep in touch with that. And the opportunities that we all now have, thanks to social media and all of these things, I think still employs those ideas those century-old pioneers had.
Religion was very much at the beginning of broadcasting, wasn't it? It was part of the very first broadcasts.
Absolutely. You can go right back to Marconi in the sort of 1900 or so, was actually talking about this idea of using radio to link together God's kingdom. And that's an incredible idea behind that. The world's first speech broadcast, essentially, Christmas Eve 1906, inventor called Reginald Fessenden read Luke's gospel, not all of it, but it was Christmas Eve, so we did the Annunciation to the shepherds. I love that idea that literally the very first words ever heard on radio anywhere in the world were, "Do not be afraid." And people were terrified because they'd heard Morse code, and that was it. And then Reith comes along, BBC, and that idea of we need to give people not just low form of entertainment, but elevate the conversation. And that certainly was the idea behind those early broadcasts. And I think that's still something that public service broadcasting can stand for today.
The church was a bit alarmed, wasn't it, that people might be listening to worship wearing hats, standing in pubs and
That's
things.
true. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Reith wanted to broadcast the royal wedding between what became George VI and the Queen Mother, as many of us would have known her. So this is spring 1923, and the royal couple were behind it, but the Dean of Westminster said exactly what you just said. Men could be listening in pubs with their hats on, and you couldn't plan what state people would be in when they heard this sort of thing. And in a way, it's a fun idea behind that sort of comment. But at the same time, the whole idea of broadcast, and when we do pause for thought, you have to imagine who's listening to this. Is
Yeah.
it someone on a school run? Is it a trucker? Is it, and I've done, you do the nine, so the 7:15 pause for thought, but I've done the middle of the night ones. You've got to imagine the late night truckers and the night shift workers,
Yeah.
those who can't sleep. So yeah, sometimes you do have to think we are meeting people where they are. And behind the very first religious broadcast in this country, the first broadcast church service, a few months before the BBC, a guy called James Ebenezer Boone in Peckham had this idea to use radio to send a church service out there for the housebound and hospitalized. And people then sent him telegrams and messages saying, it's incredible that I can't get to a church because I'm ill or whatever, have been for many years. And you brought it to me where I am in my bed, you know, and they felt so blessed by that. And that's, you know, so forget in pubs and pubs with hats on. If you meet reach people, if you can bless people in lying in a sick bed, you know, I've just come out of hospital myself, you know, and I've had many, many hospital stays. So I feel this very personally that it, the opportunities of not just broadcasting, but of using technology for connection to bless people, absolutely vital, important and helpful.
At 7:20 in the morning, you could be talking to people, not just not wearing hats, but not wearing anything at all if they're in the shower.
Very good point. I've had friends who, what's lovely about doing the Pulse of Thought as well, is you often get texts from friends I've not heard from for literally decades. People I was at university with saying, yeah, I was just putting the porridge on and happened to hear your voice, or got in the car and I normally don't hear it because I'm, you know, doing off to work, but I was doing the school run today, or indeed, you know, I was in the shower. I think I don't need to know that bit, but thanks. But good to know, you know, so there is that.
So I've heard your stand-up, Paul, and you're very funny. I'm not sure you're much of a political comedian, though. Would that be fair?
I think that is fair. Yeah, and I think I sometimes wonder about that. But at the same time, I have the early years of my writing career. I was writing for the News Quiz and the Now Show. Radio 2 had a show called Parsons and Ailer's Pull Out Sections, and we did Dead Ringers. I've done about half a dozen at least of the topical comedy shows. Not saying that necessarily means I was in any case a political writer, because often you're trying to find an angle on the week's news that kind of makes it either a bit silly or simplifies it, or some easy accessible way in. So as a writer, I've done that a bit in the past, and occasionally on stage I do have a little bit of a yeah, I think it's a platform that you got to use carefully. And I know from experience that actually I'm at my best on stage when I'm probably at my silliest. And silly jokes, one-liners, props, silly songs, whatever. But occasionally, yeah, you can make a point. And I certainly, absolutely stand up for the many other, those maybe actually those few stand-ups who do use their platform to raise the bar a bit and elevate the conversation and punch up, and certainly not punch down. And in fact, that's one change I maybe have made over the years. I'm not perfect by a long shot, and I've been gigging now for 20 years. But when I started out, I know I've done jokes in the past that punched down. I was never particularly Frankie Boyle, or actually, in fairness, Frankie Boyle doesn't punch down. I think he punches up, but I was never that outrageous or edgy. But I know that I have done jokes that victimized someone in the audience, or a celebrity, or maybe even a group of people, which I look back on and I go, A, was, I think, wrong and unhelpful. And, you know, picking on people, I never made a habit of it, but if someone heckled, you try and think of some sort of put down that has a go at them. I've changed. I think the nature of comedy has changed as well. And I've seen comedians lately who've been going since the 90s and the noughties, still trying to do their edgy stuff. And actually, audiences have changed. We've now seen stand-up on telly, which is Britain's Got Talent, live at the Apollo. It's a bit more family-friendly. I think also society generally, we are, some people say, more cautious about offence and the like. I see it as a good thing that actually we no longer really actually just, we have more accountability, I think, about what we say, maybe.
Yeah. And what about politics and the pulpit? Do you think the church should keep its nose out of politics, or are they inseparable?
Well, I think it's a bit inseparable, but I think it's such a, politics is such a catch-all term, isn't it? You know, I always think of politics with a big P and politics with a little P in a way. So politics with the big P, you know, party political preaching is certainly risky. I'm not saying it should never happen, but it's, you know, if you're as a in the pulpit and you know, it's not a place to tell people where to vote, I think. But with a small P, you know, we are all political. And I remember after the, was it around the Brexit referendum, and everyone got a little more opinionated on social media. And a family member of mine was saying, everyone's a politician now, aren't they, online? You know, can't we just go back to sharing cat videos and the like? I think, yeah, but at the same time, when big things happen in our lives, and it can be, you know, the migrant crisis is such a huge thing. to what degree do we remove ourselves? Do we never engage with that, you know, as people and as preachers? And social justice, of course, such a vital part, I think, of what role the church can and should play. So I think, yeah, absolutely, you have to engage with these things to a degree, but it's that tricky thing, isn't it? To what degree people make mistakes. We're all human and fallible, and sometimes we'll overstep. But hopefully there's a bit of a line between campaigning for what's right and saying you should put your X in this box, you know. So I think in that sense, I'm going to say maybe.
It's funny, cat videos had a mention last week as well, partly because we were thinking about how awful the news is, and sometimes you just have to cut off from it, and cat videos can be amusing.
Exactly.
But anyway, we're recording this a little bit away from the actual date this is relevant to, i.e. Sunday the 19th, and the headlines at the moment are about the potential ceasefire in Gaza, train strikes, but we're all very much hoping that the suffering will come to an end for all parties in the Middle East, because it's been so absolutely ghastly.
Absolutely.
So let's turn our thoughts to the readings for Sunday the 19th of May. I think there is a very obvious theme that kind of leaps out and grabs you. I just wondered, if you were preaching then on that Sunday, what would you be going for as your topic?
Well, I think if you didn't do Pentecost, it would be odd, wouldn't it, really? And it's Pentecost, really. So Acts 2 is of course, the key reading here. It's one of the readings, and it's, I think, the key reading. It's the Holy Spirit coming. It's one of those festivals in church that I think sometimes we don't know quite what to do with it, or parishioners maybe, or congregants sometimes can not quite be sure what to do with it. So sometimes it's a way of the preacher to lead the way a bit on this one, because we know what Christmas is. The world knows what Christmas is. The world has a pretty good idea what Easter is. Although that said, I do remember doing Pause for Thought on a couple of Good Fridays. I kept wondering why you always got me to do Good Friday on Pause for Thought. And it took me a while to realize that actually it's quite helpful to have a Christian on Good Friday, probably. And a lot of the Christian ministers are a bit busy kind of doing church services and things. So the Christian comedian was probably the, in case of emergency, break glass on Good Friday. But I've had a few stand-in hosts who, between the songs, you know, we're about to do the Pause for Thought on Good Friday, Easter weekend. And I've had literally at least a couple of the stand-in hosts go, so what is Good Friday? And this is off air, you know, we're about to do the Pause for Thought, and go, is that when Jesus was born? Or and you think, you kind of thought you'd know this stuff, like that, the 101 stuff.
Yes. There's a tremendous advert that was put out by Tesco's a few years ago now. I read it on Maundy Thursday, travelling back up home to Macclesfield. And the advert was, Good Friday just got better, beer and wine on special offer. which I did actually make a bit of a fuss about, and Tesco withdrew the ad quite quickly.
Oh, well done.
Misunderstood the word good.
Yes, clearly. Anyway, Maundy Thursday just got maundier. That's not really yes. Maybe it's time for that to come back. But yeah, similarly, you know, Christmas we know about, Easter many kind of know about, but at the same time, reminders are helpful, I think it's fair to say.
So. Pentecost. Let's focus on that.
And Pentecost, certainly.
What's going on? When I've mentioned this before, but when we do scriptural reasoning with Jewish and Muslim friends, we look at each other's scriptures together, and the practice involves reading a text, and then everyone in the group picking out a particular word that leaps out at them from the reading. And reading the Acts word, I was noting down the words that leapt out at me, and there really are rather a lot of them that are very surprising in the context of a scriptural reasoning. I've got violent wind, bewilderment, utterly amazed, amazed and perplexed. Oh gosh, they're not drunk. I mean, these are things that are really, really, you know, catch your imagination. So what do you make of this? What's going on here?
It's a compelling scene, isn't it? It's one of the key scenes, really, from the Bible. And I think one of the things, of course, with the way we encounter a book, like, for example, the Bible, is every page kind of looks the same. They're all the same font size, text size. And, you know, it's only when you really properly read it and are told it that you can go, actually, this story is the birth of the church. This is massive, you know. And we have I preach at our local church here. We have a preaching team that we meet up every month or two and talk through things. And we're constantly reminding each other that actually we've got many people in our church who are new to church or newish. And we take it for granted that people have been there for years. But actually, there are many new Christians or many who come along because they bring the children along, but actually are still learning those elemental things. So for every year, although it may feel to a preacher like, oh, I've got, you know, Pentecost, here we go again. Actually, for many people coming to church, they don't know the story of Pentecost and they don't know this story. So I think on one level, a Pentecost sermon really needs to tell that story and not take anything for granted. So just give us the essentials. What happened? Who was there? And why is this so crucial in the birth story of the church, you know?
It is. I think you were saying about how to talk about Pentecost. I mean, I've had birthday cakes in the past with candles on because it is the birthday of the church. And this reading includes the first ever sermon, in fact, which Peter delivers, which is interesting. What do you make of it as a sermon? It's not got many jokes in.
Well, it hasn't. It hasn't, certainly. But it has got the accusation of they're just drunk, that's all, you know. So this, which is certainly something that stands out, the fact that these very first Christians, and, you know, within a few chapters, they are called for the first time Christians, actually get the name. But the very first accusation is that these people are drunk. That's literally what they're called, you know. And then a defense of, no, they're not. No, this is what's going on, you know. And I think there is that thing. I've been to lots of churches in the past, different types of church, deliberately. And in fact, the first book I did, called So a Comedian Walks Into a Church, was all about me trying to go around the country doing comedy shows and ending up at different types of church. And I particularly wanted to broaden my experience of that. So I've been to Pentecostal churches and evangelical churches, Anglican churches, Methodist, Baptist, and everything. And some churches that almost preach on Pentecost through the year, you know, and actually go, you know, speaking in tongues is a thing we do in this church. Other churches go, we don't really do the speaking in tongues thing. Others do. We'll get that. They did back then. Maybe that. So there's always that sort of element as well that churches will differ on. So it's worth maybe reflecting briefly on that or not. I don't know. But as a non-church leader myself, but it's just being aware of that, at least, I think, that that's something that that different churches will differ on. But either way, it's more about the message behind that, I think, and the fact that we have, I mean, look, all of these wonderful different countries are listed here. Every nation living in Jerusalem, these people are all from Galilee, and yet we hear them speaking our own native languages. Here we are, Parthians, Medes, Elamites. This is one of those readings that whoever's reading it, leaves in advance, goes, oh no, I've got to work out how to say all these words, you know, Phrygia, and the like. And we hear all these people speaking in our own languages about the wonderful things God has done.
Yeah.
Brilliant. You know,
wouldn't that have been amazing to have heard that and actually hear what they were saying about the wonderful things God had done, you know, that just to be part of that extraordinary atmosphere. But it is the words that leap out at me. This, the wind, it wasn't a, you know, a gentle breeze. It was violent.
Absolutely.
It just, you know, expresses something really quite extraordinary.
Yeah,
it is. I can write down the word extraordinary.
It's hugely dramatic. And in fact, just after Easter, I was tasked with preaching at our church. We had an all-age service, which we do every month, and it was on, I was tasked with it, the entire book of Acts. I had to summarize the entire book of Acts in about 15, 20 minutes to an all-age audience. And I thought, how in the world do I approach this, you know? And I've always enjoyed in the past hearing any sermon that actually attempts to summarize either the whole Bible or the whole Old Testament or a whole book of the Bible, because I've always learned things doing that. So I thought, right, I will do my best here to try and summarize this in some way. But, and again, how do you do it to an all-age audience? I was thinking, well, actually, the Acts, really, so much happens. It's an active book, you know, and this is one of the most active parts of it. So it felt to me like a Netflix drama series, and it felt like one of those previously in the Bible, you know, here's your little summary of what happened. So we kind of whizzed through the book chapter by chapter, like their episodes in your latest binge watch. And because it's got prison breaks and storms and the growth of the church and all of these things. And this scene essentially is huge as well. And so then what I did to make it all age was kind of cast it a little bit, wrote a keyword out that each of the Peter and Paul and John and the prison guard and things might say. and have them almost acted out like a nativity. So that way that sort of got it acted on its feet a little bit more. Of course, it was a pale imitation of how it may have looked at the time. But as you say, this is a scene that I think does deserve to be pictured in some way and imagined. Of put yourself in that scene. What would this have been like? You know, because it's a huge moment, almost one of the last huge moments in the Bible, because after this, of course, we get more letters and theology and the like. So in terms of the actual things that happened when the church began, this is it. It's where it all comes from.
And what is the key message for you that comes out of this particular extraordinary passage?
Well, I think you've got, I think there's some risks actually in this passage in a way, and the way it can be interpreted, because there can maybe be a tendency to think of Pentecost and the delivery of the Spirit, the Spirit's descent with us, as sometimes a passive thing that actually, you know, where there's the waiting on the Spirit, there's often that sort of tendency to think of that. You know, we wait on Jesus. Whereas I sometimes wonder, what if he's waiting on us? You know, what's our role in this? You know, it's not just about us just waiting and waiting and, you know, things might happen and those sorts of things. So in a way, sometimes, because we're talking, because the text sometimes makes us think about things that will happen and the disciples are there waiting for things to happen. But this is a thing that has happened in the past. Jesus has been, he's come to earth, he's died, he's raised, he's ministered, he's ascended, and now the Spirit has descended. It's the completion of that Trinity in a way. So that's happened. So in a way, I kind of think we've got to stop waiting for the Spirit to descend and maybe start living that spirit-filled life. What does that mean to us now that we've got that Spirit moving through us? And one of the keys to that, I think, is, as we said, so many languages and nations living here together, this is a story for everyone. There's a lot in Acts about, you know, it begins in Jerusalem and it ends much more global, you know, ends in Rome, but via all sorts of places around there. And it, what I love as well, which I only really clocked when we went through this Acts guide recently, was it specifies the numbers of people. You start off with a dozen and then, you know, 100, then it's 500 or 1200. And it specifies specific amounts of people, believers that that were there that day and the growth of the church. You can kind of clock it in a way. So, and it's for everyone, it's for all. So this is, I think, something that really says we need to be thinking of unity and thinking of others who are, and praying for others who are not like us, you know, which goes back to the whole love thy neighbor thing. You know, who is my neighbor? The fellow across the world, the family we don't know, they're all part of God's hope for the world.
I think you touched on there something that springs out for me, that this is very much a beginning, isn't it? The kind of the waiting, that all the big events that were going to happen have happened. Now the Spirit's come, now we start. This is where the gospel breaks out and goes out to all the world, as in, you know, all the people speaking it in different languages. Also, we think of Pentecost, you know, it's sort of been so adopted into the Christian faith. We think of it as, oh, it's a Christian festival. But of course, it's a Jewish festival, Pentecost. It was also a kind of harvest festival, where it was the end of the barley season, the beginning of the wheat season, apparently. And it was also seen as the day Moses received the law traditionally. So in a way, there's also that beginning, in a sense, that the law of Moses, you know, wonderful, and obviously the bedrock of all Jesus's teaching. But now we kind of move on. This is the new bit, new beginning, the birthday, if you like.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. And I think something that also that reminds me of as well is there's that constant push-pull, I think, you get in many churches, again, depending on what church you go to, different flavors, of our relationship with ritual and our relationship with things that do repeat. And I know I've been to churches that go, to Anglican churches as well, that have the two different sides of it. The church I go to right now is actually quite ritualistic, and we like sticking to those annual things that come around again. My previous Anglican church was very much like, no, we're just, you know, for the next 12 weeks, we're going to be doing something about that completely different, that is in no way that you've never heard before. Different themes. We had 7 weeks in a row where it was all themed on different colors of the rainbow. You know, what does it mean that God is the creator of red and you know, the like, and drawing out some of those themes. Both have, I think, a very valid place, but there is a sense of ritual, as you say, that the fact this is a Jewish festival, it's a Christian festival, it's something that comes around every year. And I like a bit of, I mean, I quite like a bit of ritual. You know, I like a bit of the, I like that idea that we are connecting through do it, through celebrating this with those who've gone before, year in, year out, and celebrating that fact. And I think sometimes it's nice to be tethered back to that again, just to remind ourselves of all that's gone before and all that will come, you know.
So the Acts reading is clearly the kind of overwhelming steer for Sunday's teachings. But also we ought to touch on the other readings too, the reading from Romans 8, 22 to 27, for example. And I just wrote here, there's a lot of groaning going on.
There is a lot of groaning.
It's an interesting, you know, term, I find.
Yeah, all creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time.
Yeah. And the first fruits of the spirit, you know, are associated with groaning inwardly. It's not just a joyous outbreak of happiness. There's a pain to this process, which I think is interesting, especially talking to a man freshly out of hospital.
Well, I've heard a lot of groaning in the last week in hospital, and you know, I wasn't on the maternity ward. Obviously, I'm male, but there was you know, I was in overnight, and you don't get a lot of sleep on a shared ward in a hospital when other patients are suffering at different things, you know. But that's part of life, you know. It's part of life, and you come through it. You come through the groans, but you have to groan now and then. You have to, you know. I'm speaking to you now, it's sitting in a comfy chair with cushions, but that's life, you know. And you heal, you recover, you go through. But this is, as we'd said in the Acts reading, it's the birth of the church, and almost the Romans reading then, in accompanying the birth with the groans. You can see the link there, you know, the pains of childbirth. It's not necessary. The birth is not a straightforward process, and it's a dramatic and intense process. And with that comes the fact that we lament, you know, we groan, because it says up to the present time and beyond. You know, I would say we look at the news now, and there's constant worry, concern for the world, and that is the world we're in, you know. But then there's also the line in verse 23 of Romans 8 here. We too wait with eager hope for the day when God will give us our full rights as his adopted children, including the new bodies he has promised us. Right now, I could do with a new body. Trust me, I really could. But we're adopted by God. You know, that's a wonderful thought as well. The fact that actually it's all this talk about the birth and groaning, and I'm well aware we're two men here talking about this. But yeah, God's adopted us, whoever we are, across the world, all these different nations, and the Spirit is for all, and God's plan is for all. We have this adopted father, which we pray every time we do the old Our Father prayer. You know, that's who we're praying to. And we go through those times of this process, which is what the whole world is, I think, of lament and groaning as part of that, I guess.
What do you make of the first fruits of the Spirit? Have you encountered that, experienced that yourself?
Well, I think it's one of those... the first fruits, of course, you know, there's that whole thing as well of giving the first fruits is back to God again, is so huge and important. So that's something I think we should be, you know, dwelling on ourselves, certainly. The thing is, I grew up in a Anglican church. When I became a student, I started going to different sorts of church. And I kind of got a feeling that the church I grew up in was a little bit... less confident in the Spirit in a way, you know. And I've been to other churches though that go all Spirit and not much God and Jesus, in a way. So I think probably the battle for the church is to work out what the Trinity, which ones of the Trinity we need to be dwelling on at any one time. But it all goes back to the Father, you know. The Spirit is there to help us. It descends upon us, and it helps us deliver that back to the Father again. So that's where it all comes from.
How much would you see your comedic abilities, as it were, as a gift of the Spirit, a fruit of the Spirit? It's not specifically mentioned, is it, comedy, particularly in the Bible? Everyone says, oh, Jesus was a great stand-up, but...
It's not, is it? But at the same time, and I think, but so many of us, I think, we don't know our own strengths a lot of the time, unless we're American, in which case we know really well, and we tell a lot of people about it. And I mean, that's a good thing. But... you know, we have a sense of being, oh, no, not me, certainly. And sometimes it needs others to tell us these things. Obviously, we don't want to get a big ego about it. But at the same time, Also, as a comedian, we have a habit. I mean, it's true of every different job. You have a different way of being and how you turn up to your work. As a comedian, we turn up and we hide in a green room. We walk on stage, walk off. Thank you. Good night, everybody. Get in a car and go home. And then move on to the next place. But it's only sometimes going back to a place, or thanks to social media, that you hear from people who go, actually, that thing was really helpful. You know, I did. I'm doing this. The show I'm doing at the minute, as well as the stand-up shows, is linking back to what we said at the start, sort of retelling the story of old radio and the origins of the BBC. And there's no one around now really who remembers the birth of the BBC because it was 102 years ago. But I've had people coming to that show in their 90s. Sometimes I had someone recently who came along to the show and said she told me afterwards that she's not been to an entertainment show in over 10 years, and there's partly she just didn't find anything she wanted to see. This came along at the right time. A friend recommended to it, and she said just the chance to come out and just laugh and learn and enjoy it. And I don't take that as a boost for my ego particularly, but it just makes you realize like what a joy it is that you can put a thing on that people can come along to and go home feeling a bit better about themselves or the world or whatever it might be. So in those things, I think suddenly you can go, actually, this is kind of I'm glad to be using those fruits of the spirit in that sense. If that's a purpose, that'll do me. That's great.
We also look at the final reading too, the reading from John 15, 26, and then 16, 4b to 15.
Yes.
And this talks about the coming of the Spirit, and the different terms for the Spirit too, as our advocate is mentioned here. It's one of these bits of John that I find quite difficult, but I wondered what you made of it and what you would like to draw from that as something we could bring to the preaching on Sunday.
Yeah, I did a bit of. I did theology as a degree years ago now, so I've
Did
forgotten it
you
all.
really? I
I
didn't know
did,
that.
I did, and with a particular focus on John's gospel, and we did a lot. I recall on this notion of the advocate, you know, that actually that's his terminology for the Spirit, which is a wonderful idea. I think that I like what I do like about John's gospel is that he just does give that different angle on things, and. You know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're all sort of at different times overlap and they're like, John does his own thing, you know, and the way that a spirit can advocate for us to the Father. I think, okay, that's a different angle on that sort of attitude. Of course, all of those things come with the risk of overthinking anything. And before you know it, you've got a some sort of, you know, it's like you're turning up at one of, which is the bishop who turned up and got punched by St. Nicholas for, you know, Arianism and the like. You know, you have these different, belief systems that go too far, but at the same time, advocating the spirit advocating for us, marvelous. The spirit of truth, John describes this as. And yeah, that's for me helpful. I think as a reminder, sometimes I know we always hear these different talk about truth, though. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. We know, I think, that inbuilt encouragement and importance of truth, the search for truth. And tying it with today's world, in a sometimes people say a post-truth world, let alone, you know, we've had fake news, we've had that era, that ship has sailed, you know. Now I think we're almost onto fake history, you know, with AI and the like, you know, the fact you can't trust any more video that you're seeing within, if that's not true now, it is within 6 months' time. This is literally the year of change in terms of how we trust the news, how we trust what we're told, what is shared online, reading more carefully, looking at sources more carefully. We all need to be doing this in a way that probably academics were the only ones doing many years before. But I've seen things, you know, being shared online that actually a few days later, someone go, you know, known journalists go, oh, we hadn't realized actually we shared something that was probably propaganda, whatever it might be. So the search for truth is getting trickier. And the fact that this is a spirit of truth within us, great. But once again, like I was saying earlier, there's not a passivity to that. There's got to be an active. We've got a role to play in this, and that is our determination of what is true, and amplifying that. And I've seen, and I'm not pointing fingers or anything, but I've seen Christians. I know of Christians who, in the last few years, have, I think, probably said things, you know, in the public space that are. You know, if they're knowingly untrue to go about to further a different cause, a political cause, or whatever it might be, that is something I think that we need to be conscious of, put it that way. So I'd probably talking around the issue a little bit too much, but I just think in a world of political extremism and the like, we just need to be very cautious that actually truth is at the heart of everything. That needs to be kind of ring-fenced the truth, and then everything else will be okay, I think.
I actually wrote down a passage from this reading in John chapter 16, which I wanted to share with you, because it's kind of, in a way, John writes it out like a really neat, logical package. And I wonder what you make of it. When he comes, he will prove the world to be in the wrong about sin and righteousness and judgment. About sin, because people do not believe in me. About righteousness, because I am going to the Father, where you can see me no longer. And about judgment, because the prince of this world now stands condemned. A very neat little package there. But what do you take from that?
Yeah, he's a great writer. I think he really is. I think it's he does unpack things in a way that is just very helpful. Although I say helpful, at the same time using terminology that, you know, and again, if we're preaching at a church, I think sometimes words like sin and righteousness and judgment are things that they all come with. We might think we know what we mean by them, but sometimes your listeners, your congregants, your audience might need some help with that as well. So I think there is an element that we need to be cautious of that. Well, not cautious, but just aware of that, certainly, as we approach those things. So in this case, then, Jesus has come to upturn these things. And in terms of what we thought of as sin, and how he has absorbed that for us.
Sin is not believing in him, in fact.
Yeah. Well, there you are. You know, exactly. I think he's redefining, in a way, what we think of as sin. He's redefining all of these words, righteousness and judgment as well.
Yeah.
Because that's what Jesus does. He redefines, you know, the past is the past, and he is the way from now on, you know. Yeah. So, definitely. And as it then goes on to say that when the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. So this is not an easy task. This is not something that we can just go, you know, I wouldn't necessarily expect that everyone at the end of the sermon goes, oh yeah, I get it. I've heard the reading now. I get it now. Everything's fine. We need help with this. So that's okay. It's okay to be helped along the way.
Yeah. Okay, Paul. Well, I think our time together is coming to a close. I'm particularly grateful for you doing all this while probably not feeling 100%.
Oh, that's absolutely fine. I'm very delighted to be in your company and sitting down. I'm very glad to be as a stand-up. I'm very happy to be sitting down for some time. So I'm available for all sorts of sit-down bookings for the foreseeable.
Presumably you're not going to be on stage much in the next few days, at least.
Well, you say that. I'm doing a show down the road, literally a mile away, and I'm thinking I can get a taxi, and if they can get me a soft and comfy chair, I will be there, you know, a few days after my being in hospital. But I've had to cancel a few shows and things, but that's such is life, and we're all works in progress, and I'm looking forward to these new bodies that we've been promised in this.
Yes, well, come along. But you can also have an opportunity to push your podcast, because you broadcast yourself, don't you?
I do, that's true, yes. Yeah. So the podcast, whenever you start a creative project, you never know how it will end up, I think. And that's part of the joy of it. So, the British Broadcasting Century is my podcast. I make it myself. It's not a BBC podcast, but it's about the BBC, by which I mean the British Broadcasting Company, the very early years. And I kind of thought I would have stopped by now. Once the BBC is sort of celebrated centenary and we got to its launch, I kind of thought, well, that'll be it. And then you discover, oh no, now the story just gets going, because then you get the innovations and the first firsts of broadcasting, the first radio drama, the first religious broadcast, all those ideas that really came about from just people going, we've got a microphone, we've got to use it somehow. You know, they say the microphone was the most voracious beast known to man, because you've just got to keep feeding it. And I think the same is certainly true now, you know. So I've loved delving into those earliest tales and finding new things, I think, as well, about some of those very early moments. So that's been really exciting. And
we must find the anniversary, a big anniversary of Pause for Thought, and celebrate it at some time. There must be the first time it was ever called Pause for Thought and broadcast as Pause for Thought.
Indeed, I think it was April, which is, we just had one of them, and I think it was 1970 or 67, can't remember, but it was, yeah, I think it was sometime around then. It was definitely spring. Spring is a good time for new changes, new starts, clearly. So
Like Pentecost.
Like Pentecost.
All right.
Perfect. Look at that. Smooth.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. So just to say to our lovely listeners and viewers, if you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave a review. And you can also please share it with friends. We also have online spaces for further engagement and discussion about faith and politics on Twitter at Public Issues or using the hashtag Politics in the Pulpit. We also have a Facebook group, which you can access through the Joint Public Issues Team's Facebook page and the website jpit.uk. That's JPIT.uk. There's some great stuff on there. Thanks to producer Annie. Thanks so much to Paul so much. And we'll see you again next week.